Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you through their stories, life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves and welcome to a brand new program in the award-winning series of Listen to Older Voices. This is a special Baby Boomers edition featuring the four-part story of Chris Stockley. Born in the United Kingdom in 1948, Chris became enamoured at a young age with music. He was 14 when the British music scene exploded around him, but was forced to leave the UK by his parents when they chose to move to Australia. It was a period when it was all happening for Chris in the UK, but now he found himself in Australia, in Melbourne, where he eventually became a member of some of Australia's most loved bands, such as Campact, Axiom and the Dingoes, just to name a few. In this program, Chris takes us back to his earliest memories, and we meet his parents and grandparents and learn a little about his formative years and how he developed a love for rock and roll, but a passion for blues. We follow him to Australia, where he connects with a young man, John Pugh, who had a similar taste for music and in the same genres. Here I am now, talking with Chris. Can we start by asking you, when were you born and whereabouts were you born?
I was born January 24th, 1948, in St Paul's Hospital, Winchester, Hampshire, England.
What would be your earliest memories? Do you have memories from that period?
Not quite to that day. it's funny how you think about that, and I think sometimes one may think they have a memory, but it's something they might have heard their parents speak of. So really, I can only honestly say my early memories are not of a baby, but maybe a bit of a toddler, and my granddad, and, you know, I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, you know, because my dad was often, he used to do a lot of work on the boats going between Cape Town and England, so he was away for long periods of time, and my granddad kind of was, you know, took care of me a lot, and he was always gardening, you know, used to, you know, back in those days, you grew everything yourself, and, you know, we used to eat what he grew, which was quite a fascinating concept, isn't it, really?
Yes. We think we've invented it these days.
Yeah, yeah.
What about Grandma? Do you have memories of
that? Oh, yeah, yeah. I was lucky I knew both sets of grandparents, the bigger family, the aunts and uncles from that era. There were some characters, I can tell you, some you wouldn't want to associate with, and some were wonderful people, but I was pretty lucky, like... My maternal grandparents were really, really wonderful people. My maternal grandmother used to take in foster children because, you know, I mean, they went through two wars, so they're obviously people to be cared for, and she did a lot of that. And my granddad was, of course, he fought in the First World War. He was at the Somme and those sort of battles where he got buried alive and shell-shocked and, wow. You know, all that sort of stuff and come back and... I told him how to use a knife and fork and give him a gun and said, back to the front. So off he was there. I think he was there for virtually the extent of the war. I'm sure that affected him, but he was a very gentle and kind man and he didn't talk about the war much. My other grandparents, I never knew quite as well. They always lived out of town from us. My grandfather was in the Second World War. He was on the boats that were doing the runs to Russia. You know, with food and supplies to Russia. And my uncle and my grandfather and my father were awarded much, much later in life from the Russian government for services to Russia. And my father, you know, did the usual thing. He joined up before he was old enough. And
of course.
Because they were his brother and father were on the boat, so he was on the boat. So that was a real dangerous thing. The North Sea, you know, they had... no protection from submarines and all that sort of thing. So you can see my family, and my dad was in a tank regiment as soon as he was old enough to join up properly. My family had a fairly sort of, you know, interesting life in that it was kind of military and, you know, not to say military, I mean, everyone had to, it was, you know, service, wasn't it? You know, you had to go in whether you wanted to or not,
that's right.
You know. But you know, they all did their, you know, their stuff. And
so even after the war finished, your father stayed on boats. Is it merchant?
No. Well, he went on, you know, what do you call it, merchant seaman. Yeah. He did that for a while, but then he had it. Mum got fed up with him being away so much, so he just got, you know, regular work, office work, whatever you did. And strangely, his brother stayed on the boats and eventually got off in Melbourne. And that paternal grandfather stayed in the merchant navy as well. He was on the Thames doing stuff or something, you know.
Right.
And, yeah, so my uncle, my dad's brother, was the first one to actually move to Australia. And his mother and father followed him.
Gotcha.
And that's the first Australian contact.
Mum, you mentioned her a few times. Was she living with you and your grandparents?
My mum?
Yeah.
No, we always lived very, very closely together. We lived outside of the city of Winchester. It was pretty customary to people to stay fairly close.
Yes.
And I don't think my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, were ever more than 5 or 10 minutes away from my mum and dad where we lived. In fact, when my mum and dad went back to England from Australia, they actually had the same semi-detached house.
Oh,
they lived right, you can't get any closer. They shared a wall, and that was kind of, you know. But it was almost like village life, you know, that they came from and kind of went back to, you know, even though Winchester's far from a village, you know, it's a city with a big cathedral and all that. But that era was still very much a village mentality, I think.
Yes. Yeah. What about for you as a young boy growing up there? Was it an enjoyable environment for you? Did you have many friends?
Yep, had lots of friends. You know, you make serious friends once you start going to school, I suppose. And
school life, did you enjoy that?
I've never been one for institutionalised anything. I've never been a joiner. You know, I never joined the Scouts or any of that stuff that most kids did. I think I've always been a bit weird in that regard, and it's followed me through my whole life. And but I always had plenty of friends, and I always seemed to manage to have friends from different areas in as far as class, for want of a better word, and interests. You know, I always had. I didn't limit my friendships to sport or later on just to music, or the music in the end took over, let's face it, be honest about that. You know, I was always friends with a lot of different people, you know, and never really in one particular group of friends. So I was fortunate in that. And I used to do a lot of things. I used to really enjoy football, and but later on, once I'd heard music, it took over. I gave up everything for music, you know.
As a young boy growing up, this lack of desire to, as you put it, not be involved in institutionalisation, you know, via organised clubs and things like that. Did that cause a problem in school for you? Because weren't you expected to sort of, you know, join the school sports or join the school?
Yeah, well, you're pretty well. I mean, in school you didn't really have much say in it.
Right.
And that was okay. But outside of school, when there were all these things like, you know, well, initially Cubs and Scouts and all that sort of, you know, sports clubs and things. I tried it a few times. I just didn't sort of get along in that environment. And whether that was a reaction to the fact that my father and both sets of grandparents had a very disciplined lives and being in the Army and the Navy and stuff like that, you know.
Yes.
Maybe it was a rebellion against that. I don't know. Because my dad wasn't too bad, but my paternal grandfather was really strict, quite, you know. Well, if I compare both grandfathers, the one, there's one I liked him, one I didn't really care for that much, and that was him. Yeah, the other, my maternal grandfather, the one, as I mentioned before, in the First World War, and that he was really gentle, kind, and didn't like ordering people about or any of that. So, you know, I think he had a reaction from his time in the war and the services, you know. But he was different, you know. Really understanding, gentle person, whereas my paternal grandfather was still very much a disciplinarian, you know, captain of the ship,
right,
sort of thing. No rubbish here, weren't you? Fooling around, you know,
do as you're told. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, Ageless Stories on Ageless Radio.
I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm talking with Chris Stockley. And Chris is recollecting his early years and stories of his family and extended family.
The family life as you grew up, Did you guys have television in those days as a young child, or was it radio?
I forget when we first got television. I know initially we just had, you know, the wireless like everyone else, and that was the source of entertainment. I think we got television, must have been 10 or around that age.
So that would have been about the same time as Australia then. Yeah,
50. Well, maybe a bit earlier than that. Right. I don't know. I remember going next door to my next door neighbours and watching their TV. They had one before we did.
Yeah.
And then later on, when ITV came in, you know, the commercial station, they had that before. You know, we had just had BBC, so we used to go and watch Superman on their TV, you know, and that sort of thing.
Didn't we all?
Yeah. And eventually, of course, we got it all.
But did radio play an important part of your life, or was it just an adjunct to everything else?
Radio did once I got involved in, once I had rock and roll. I mean, radio was a big part, but you got to remember that the radio in England was pretty awful.
Mm.
It was largely classical and really wimp pop. And we used to listen to the music on Radio Luxembourg, you know, which was, you know, it would float by and you'd try and dial it in. And that's when we first started hearing rock and roll and stuff like that.
How old would you have been, roughly, when that's entered your life?
Okay, I was around about 8 or 9, and there used to be this group of roughhead kids, and they had a wind-up record player in 78s, and we were pretty scared of them. But they used to go up on the hill, where I used to live in the place called the Valley, and they play these records, and me and my mate, we were too scared to approach them because they looked pretty tough, you know. And we used to sit up there or sit up in the tree and listen to the music, which we really loved. And one day they said, come down if you want to listen to the music. So we're going, well, okay. And then, oh, man, I heard Elvis Presley do Lordy Miss Claudy, and it changed my world. And they turned it over and played Trying to Get to You, which is still one of the greatest vocal things Elvis ever did. And the emotion and the feel of that music never left me. And they had Little Richard, wow. Chuck Berry, Eddie Cochran a bit later on, but these all the 78s, you know, on a wind-up player, you change the needle, and that was it. And then the final nail in the coffin is I'd been home from school with some kind of disease, and I wasn't supposed to go back to school, and you know, the full 2 weeks had gone by, and I was okay, I was well, but I wasn't allowed to go back to school. So my mum said, oh, for God's sake, you've got to get out of the house, and gave me money, enough to get in the cinema, so I walked to Winchester City and went to see Loving You. Now, I'd never heard of this before, but Mum said, oh, you're like this. This is like Elvis Presley or was on about. And I was just completely blown away because I didn't know what Elvis looked like.
Of course, you know, heard the voice.
To me, it was a bloke with a really strange name.
Yes.
And I figured, yes, with a name like Elvis Presley, he must have looked like Lonnie Donegan, who kind of looked like my dad. And I thought, well, I'm not going to be into that. Anyway, when Elvis came on the screen and there was this kid who was so happy and so full of joy and loved music so much, and you just laughed watching him sing and perform. And it was that was it. You know, I just basically at that moment chucked at everything, and all I wanted to do was be involved in music. So that was it. The die was cast.
The die was cast.
Yeah.
Did you or your parents ever have a job or profession in mind that they thought or you thought you might have gotten into? Or were you so young that you decided music was it before anything else happened?
I never crossed my mind about career or anything like that. You know, certainly not at that age.
Mm.
And although I love music so much, I could never see myself performing it. I mean, that was something that other people did, you know. I mean, I didn't think about work, but I ended up, my first job was like in an office kind of thing, office/messenger boy type thing, but it was always music. But I do remember when I was about 11 or 12 having a dream, I was up singing, which is pretty incredible because I hadn't had much experience in actually seeing people live at that stage, and I thought, aroused something in me, and I don't think, it was only a dream, but it never left me either, that I went, I could perform, and that was bizarre.
Interesting.
Yeah, but anyway, that was just a dream. But I must say that music just interfered with every aspect of my life. You know, and I was an absolute pain in the ass because I could not understand why everybody didn't love Elvis and Little Richard and all these people, and how they could possibly be interested in anything else, let alone any other music. You know, and you'd get to school assignments to do, and mine always involved music. Yeah, and I was, you know, I used to come at him and they'd go, the teacher went, can you write about anything else? You know, you broaden your horizons a bit. And I thought, I don't know about anything else. This is it. Yeah, so that was the large part. I was going through my early teenage years at this stage then. And, you know,
so you would have been at a very young, informative age where you were sucking everything in when all of a sudden these four guys called the Beatles started.
Yeah, well, the Beatles was a whole different thing because by this stage I'd followed the usual route that most musicians of my age did. That was you discovered Elvis, then you discovered, say, Little Richard, and then it was Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, and then it was Muddy Waters and Harlan, and you went back until you discovered Robert Johnson, and you started working back from that again, and the whole blues thing.
So you were doing that at a very young age?
I was about 14, 15 when I discovered, or maybe even younger, yeah, because it wasn't far long after. It didn't take me long to get from Little Richard to Chuck Berry, and then Chuck Berry to Bo Diddley and so on. So, yeah, I was pretty young when I discovered that sort of music. And then that was when the R&B boom happened in England, because trad jazz was like the cool music, yeah. And rock and roll was kind of a bit naff, you know. But then it transpired that the cool people were getting to this rhythm and blues thing, which wasn't quite rock and roll, but at the same time it kind of was, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was huge. And so it was quite an exclusive club. We all thought we were pretty smart as R&B fans. Mm. And then because there weren't too many black R&B singers or players in England, kids started doing the music. And that's when I first, you know, discovered the Rolling Stones and the Pretty Things and Manfred Mann and those bands. So the Beatles were a bit on the back burner until they actually got so huge you couldn't ignore them. And of course, everyone, that was about 62, I guess. Mm. And we loved them, absolutely. And it wasn't like, you know, I was talking about this recently, how it was, if you asked me who was top of the charts today, I wouldn't have a clue.
No.
But back then, you had no choice. It wasn't just music media, it was total media. They were everywhere, the Beatles. I mean, you knew all their songs. You knew what they were doing in their lives. It was just total. And I'd never seen anything like it, you know. And, of course, I loved the Beatles, but I always had the thing for the Stones because they were closer to the music I liked.
To the roots, yes.
And I think I saw the Stones for the first time in 1963 at a little club in Winchester called the Lido. And strangely, there's in Bill Wyman's book, there's a picture of the ticket of that night that I went.
Oh, cool.
Because they only ever played Winchester once in their entire career.
Wow.
And that was
and
it.
You were there.
And I was there, you know. Because the next time I saw them, which was a few months later in 63, was at the Southampton Gaumont, and they were on tour with Little Richard, the Everly Brothers, Bo Diddley, and a few others. You know, those big package tours, mm-hmm, 10 different mm-hmm. artists on. I mean, the Stones did four songs.
Yeah.
That was it. That was
like almost the opening act
yeah.
thing, yeah.
And, but of course, I was sold, you know, and the act was great. But of course, they were still outshone a bit by Bo Diddley. And of course, when Little Richard came on, it was...
Well, everybody was outshone by him. That's right.
And the Everlys were pretty good too, but they were a bit tame. Compared to the... I think they're on the wrong show. You know, they shouldn't have been with the Stones and Little Richard.
No.
They were really full-on aggressive stars, and the Everlys were a bit nice, although we didn't know about it at the time, but they were actually quite weird people. Anyway, yeah, so that was it. And then the everything changed at this time. This is when my uncle had moved to Australia, and then about 3 years later or so, my paternal grandparents moved to Australia because they'd just about ready to retire. And they come out here too. And they all said, look, England, you know, you'll do much better in Australia if you want my dad to work and make a living. Because we were sort of, we couldn't get out of the rut. You know, we're really working class.
Yeah.
Poor working class. And they said, look, it's better. You can come out here, you can make a quid, and you'll have a better life. Like, and let's face it, millions did.
Mm.
So anyway, eventually they talked parents into going to Australia about 3 years after they went. And so this was about January 64. So just as I was really at the height, and England was at the height of music, my parents decided to up and leave. So it tore me apart.
Mm.
And, you know, because it was just starting to happen. The Beatles were huge, the Stones were huge, and you had The Who and these other people coming in to being, and they up and left, and we did like it really tore me up. So that's how we got to be in Australia. I think we landed here something like February the 1st in 1964.
First impressions?
Hot.
Don't hold back.
It was bloody hot. And I tell you, the trip out was on a Boeing 707, which is tiny compared to the planes.
Oh, yes.
And people smoked the whole way.
God, that's right.
The whole plane was totally filled with cigarette smoke. And it was just vile, you know. It was just awful. But that's what people did then.
That's right.
And we got to Essendon Airport before Tullamarine, and it was just so hot. And then we started, I think we got picked up, and we were driven, my mum quite a place in Newport, where my grandparents was. No, they shifted out by then, I think. No, they weren't. They were still there. And we were staying with them until we got a place, you know. And we drove from Essendon through those suburbs to Newport, and we're driving up Mason Street, Newport, and my mum just burst into tears. She was obviously upset because she left her parents behind, and she just said, "There are no trees." And that's, I thought,
that's right.
It was like Mason Street, Newport, was like the face of the moon. It was just concrete.
Yeah.
There wasn't a tree to be seen.
That's right.
You know, and it was just, and it was, we'd just come from Winchester, this green, yes, beautiful town, really, really beautiful city, you know.
Yes.
And we thought, what have we done?
Listen to older voices. The magic of memories. This is a special Baby Boomers edition.
So it was hard. It was really hard to adjust. I basically went straight to work. I didn't want to go back to school, and even though I should have, because I was only just turned 16. And I got it. The first job was The Age, believe it or not. And I wish I'd stayed there. That would have been much more in keeping with my interest, later on my interest.
Mm.
But I got a better offer from an insurance company, so I went, and after a week or so at The Age, I went and worked for the City Mutual Life Insurance Company, which is a big mistake. But anyway, that's what I did, and I went to night school and got a, you know, trying to get some qualifications, because the first qualifications in England start at, you know, the end of your 16-year-old, which is your A-levels. No, O-levels, sorry, O-levels, and you go on to grammar school to do your A-levels. And I had no qualifications, and I didn't realise that in Australia every year has its own qualification. Mm. And they said, And I said, I don't have any, because we don't really start getting awarded things until we pass exams at the age of 16. So I went to night school and did English and commercial principles and stuff like that at night school, and that sort of kept everyone happy for a while. But it wasn't long before I knew that I was going to have to start doing something about music. And one of the things that inspired me then was the fact there was absolutely no one playing blues in Australia. No one. No one even heard of it. And
no.
It was heartbreaking for me. I'd go to record stores and there was just nothing. They'd never heard of it. And then, you know, bit by bit you meet people. And I'd met John Pugh at The Age office. He was working there. And we become friends, and I started playing him blues records. And he started playing me Bob Dylan records. And as a fair exchange, it's no robbery. We both wrecked each other's lives with that. But it was a really exciting time, you know.
Yeah.
And Dylan was, wow. That was as off the wall to me as what Howlin' Wolf was to John, you know.
Yes.
And we had a really good friendship. And we discovered then the Heritage Record Shop, which was above Frank Trainor's, a guy called Tony Standish. And you'd actually buy these, you know, albums on original Chess American labels, Chess and, you know, all that stuff, Muddy and Howlin' Wolf, Robert Johnson, and he had a fantastic jazz, you know, music available as well, but that was pretty well before I was interested in jazz at all. I was a strictly blues rock and roll person. And also the disc shop in Bourke Street, run by John McDonald, and had Mick Kinnear working for him in there, and that was more the rock and roll thing. He had a lot of R&B, you know, like Coasters and Contours and that kind of stuff. And between those two shops and what we could get from overseas, we started building our record collections. And because there was absolutely no one to go and see playing this music, John and I started trying to make it ourselves. So I got a guitar and he got some harmonicas, and I think the first song we learnt was Good Morning Little Schoolgirl, Sonny Boy Number One, John Lee Williamson.
You can tell your mother and your father that Sonny Boy's a little schoolboy. I woke up this morning, Lord, I couldn't make me known. Lord, I couldn't make me known.
And it's all downhill from there.
Why, that I didn't have no blues, woman, but I was all messed up.
Join Chris and I next week when Chris continues his observations on what was, in the early 60s, a pretty boring Melbourne music scene. And he shares with us how it eventually developed and his role in that development. That's next week, Chris Stockley on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.